This video wouldn't fly without Squarespace. Flying cruise ship. If this didn't get your attention, then let me tell you, this project was pure insanity. In the post-war UK, engineers envisioned a vessel of the future, a 1,000-passenger cruiser with 5 decks with bars, dining rooms, showers, and 42 crew members to wait on you hand and foot. This flying ship could transfer you from any point in the world and provide a luxury ocean liner experience. But what if I told you that there was more than just this vision? That there was more to this story, including 3 different variations that got more and more extreme. There was a nuclear power version, an even larger proposal with twin hulls, and seemingly perfect technology abandoned for one simple reason. Let's explore the question, whatever happened to the insane flying cruisers? It was called the Saunders Row Queen, and like the Queen of the United Kingdom, it would be the centre of the British aviation empire. Proposed in the early 1950s as a response to P&O's shipping request for a flying ocean liner, this would be the largest flying passenger seaplane ever conceived. But what sets this amazing aircraft apart from other similar concepts is the level of luxury that passengers would have been offered, similar to modern first-class experience on long-haul flights. The Queen would have offered first-class passengers their own bars, dining rooms, and private bathrooms, while lower-class passengers would have slept in railway-style compartments that converted from seats to berths with 6 to a room. The difference between this and our planes today wasn't simply the opulent luxury, but the fact that everyone had a bed and everyone had access to stroll around the aircraft while it was in flight, much like a luxury liner. And with a crew of 47 people, including 40 cabin stewards, it would have served passengers via elevators connecting all decks. They would have had to work in 7 separate shifts as the aircraft made its way across the globe. But what's even more insane is the engineering solutions behind this Titan that were as ambitious as the concept itself. The 24 Conway jet engines were mounted high on the wings to avoid water spray with clever dual intake systems, one set for flight and another for water operations. And it's the fact that the engineers decided to jump on board the Jet Age wagon that made this aircraft so incredible. The Rolls-Royce Conway were also the first turbofan engines to enter service, used on several aircraft of the era like the Boeing 707, the DC-8, or the Vickers VC-10. And where exactly would have they flown this giant flying palace? Well, the company behind them proposed London to Sydney, with stops in Cairo, Karachi, Calcutta, Singapore, and Darwin, and the aircraft would have revolutionized long-distance travel if only it had ever been built. But before we tell you why this project was cancelled with as much haste as someone who just discovered they aren't subscribed, we need to talk about the beginnings and the company behind it. I love this era of crazy seaplane technology with these old British engineers from the war designing incredible machines. And as an aviation enthusiast, I know the importance of precision, innovation, and seamless execution, both in the skies and online. And that's why I trust Squarespace to power my merch website at www.foundandexplained.shop. Using Squarespace's AI-powered blueprint builder, I launched a professional sleek website in just a few steps with no coding or design experience. The award-winning templates and easy drag-and-drop editing made it effortless to keep my brand looking first class. And just like air traffic control guides planes to their destinations, Squarespace's built-in SEO tools helped me get new visitors to land on my site with optimized meta descriptions, automatic sitemaps, and much more. So if you're looking at launching your own brand or selling aviation gear like me online, perhaps for your own YouTube channel, Squarespace makes it simple, stylish, and stress-free. And best of all, you can get 10% off with your first site and domain at www.squarespace.com/found. It's the 1930s, and if you want to cross the ocean, your options are pretty limited. You could spend a week on a boat, probably being seasick the entire time, or you could hop on basically what is a flying yacht, a massive aeroplane that lands on water. But these weren't just any aeroplanes, we're talking about absolute units like the Short Empire, which was basically a fancy hotel lobby with wings. Imperial Airways was running these bad boys all across the British Empire, letting passengers sip on their tea and eat fancy sandwiches while casually splashing down in harbours from Southampton to Sydney, with the other main trade plying from London to New York over the waves. And flying boats dominated this early long-distance era for two practical reasons. First, they weren't limited by the primitive grass runways of the era, with any suitable stretch of water could serve as a landing site. With major cities being based along the coast, this made a lot of sense. Secondly, their water-based design allowed them to be built larger than land planes, carrying more fuel and passengers while still having somewhere to land. This made them ideal for servicing remote colonial outposts, which often had harbours but no airfields. The ability to establish air routes without building expensive ground infrastructure made flying boats the perfect solution for connecting far-flung destinations of the empire in the pre-war period. Hence why the name of the biggest flying boat back then, the Short Empire, was so iconic. The Short Empire was like a private jet of its day, except it was more like a private yacht that somehow got airborne. With its cushy passenger cabins and dedicated sleeping berths, it made other aircraft of the time look like flying sardine cans. And I'm talking things like a promenade, sizable galley, separate bathrooms for men and women, and even individual cabins for passengers. And it wasn't alone. You also had the American Boeing 314 Clipper, which was so luxurious that it made the Titanic look like a fishing boat. Pan Am was flying these waterbound behemoths across the oceans, and passengers were living it up with full course meals served on actual china. But then, just as everyone was getting comfortable with the idea of these magnificent flying boats, along comes Saunders Row, with what can only be described as the aviation equivalent of hold my beer. And they looked at these already massive flying boats and thought, no, not big enough, let's build something really crazy. And the first flying ship was born. While many other civil industries were paused during World War II, flying boats actually got a boost. During the war, most British flying boats, if not being used to fly the route between London and New York, presumably dodging enemy aircraft as well as North Atlantic weather, were turned into maritime patrol aircraft to hunt for Nazi U-boats. Saunders Row knew that there would be a need for a new flying boat to resume passenger travel and mail delivery at the end of the war, and even as early as 1943 got to work designing something quite ambitious. This design specification defined various criteria of the proposed aircraft, which would be the largest all-metal flying boat ever built. And the performance criteria included a weight of 140 tons, a pressurized double bubble, and a huge 214-foot wingspan. And it would be quick too, flying at a top speed of 340 miles per hour at an altitude of 37,000 feet. That's why it had to be pressurized, something that wasn't typically done with flying boats back then. Its range could be maxed out at 5,000 miles and be outfitted with luxurious accommodation for a total of 104 passengers. And it's around this same time that the British government came a-knocking and would actually ask them for a new transport and reconnaissance flying boat near the end of the war. And they would invite both Saunders Row and Short to develop this four-engine aircraft, resulting in the built, but eventually scrapped, Short Shetland. Now, you see, the problem with that aircraft was that it was the jack of all trades but the master of none. Something that made Saunders Row feel like that this aircraft didn't represent their idea at all for the future of aviation, but they still saw it as a practice round for their big idea, which now had a name. The Princess. The Princess itself was a remarkable machine, the largest all-metal flying boat ever built. With its double-decker pressurized cabin that could carry 105 passengers in that luxury that I've been yapping on about this whole video, its unusual arrangement of 10 turboprop engines driving 6 propellers represented the peak of flying boat development. And in my mind, it also represented the peak of air travel, because there were two classes on board first class, and tourist. Tourist is similar to domestic or European business class today, with simple recliner seats, but then first class, you would have your own twin berth cabin, a private bar that you could go to, and a separate dressing room. So I guess you could go put on your dinner suit before attending the bar? Man, where's a class like that gone these days? Saunders Row also envisioned that this aircraft would revolutionize airports. Rather, they would have vast seaports with rainproof hangars, or bays in this context, that the giant planes would arrive at on time. BOAC would actually reach out to Saunders Row and ask them for a new long-range flying boat for their transatlantic routes. And of course, Saunders Row jumped at the chance to build the Princess for them, choosing the new British Proteus turboprop engine to power this ambitious design. By May of 1946, they'd actually won the contract for three aircraft at £2.8 million per aircraft, with each engine being around £400,000 in 1945 prices. That's £154 million today. Wow, this was going to be an expensive aircraft. But things got complicated pretty quickly during development. The project started running behind schedule and, surprisingly, over budget, making politicians nervous. Both the airframe design and the new Proteus engine were pushing engineering boundaries, and that doesn't come cheap. And then came the real blow. By 1951, BOAC had decided that they didn't actually want these planes anymore. In fact, they didn't want any flying boats at all. They'd actually stopped their existing flying boat services the year before, deciding that the future was on land, not at sea. As the contract was already locked in and they were halfway through building these three prototypes, the government tried to repurpose these aircraft for RAF transport duties, with the first prototype finally taken to the sky on August 22 of 1952. Side note, the plane wasn't actually supposed to fly that day, they were just doing taxi tests, but the conditions were so perfect with that mirror glass water that the pilot decided to go for it. The massive flying boat spent 35 minutes circling the Isle of Wight, proving that while the Princess could fly, her engines weren't quite living up to expectations. The prototype managed 46 other test flights, totaling over 100 hours, but the other two aircraft never left the ground. They were put into storage whilst the government scratched its head about what to do with them. But here's the funny thing, whilst they were trying to figure that out, the engineers at Saunders Row actually deemed that the flaw with this aircraft was the engines. That's why nobody wanted this aircraft. So they sat down and came up with two more designs. This time, powered by jets. It's now the 1950s and everyone is getting excited by jet-powered airliners. Saunders Row saw the writing on the wall and went, well, of course people want jet engines. That's why our flying boats are not popular. So they redeveloped the Princess into the Duchess, promoting the Duchess as the representation of the next generation of flying boats to various civilian airlines. The idea was that the jet engine would provide the speed of jet planes, but the seaboat design would retain the ability to land anywhere. A double win with no drawbacks. Well, kinda. Despite this, the new design was considerably smaller than the Princess and was to have been powered by lower number of engines. Six de Havilland Ghost turbojet engines tucked into the wing roots. And this would let the plane reach a top speed of 500 miles per hour, pretty impressive for a flying boat at the time. With its swept-back high-wing design, it was rather unstable on the water, hence the need for these floats on the wingtips that could be retracted in flight to reduce drag. Inside, the Duchess would feature a pressurized and air-conditioned cabin, with the most common setup carrying 74 passengers across two separated compartments, with a cargo hold in the middle to keep the weight balanced. The cabin would have had large round windows giving passengers great views of the surrounds whilst they were in flight, and there wouldn't have been any beds because the idea was that this would fly right to the destination with no sleep required. Saunders Row really pushed the Duchess, showcasing a model at the 1950s Farnborough Airshow to attract both domestic and international buyers. While it was mainly aimed at the civil market, they also saw potential military uses, proposing the Duchess for aerial reconnaissance and transport. Tasman Empire Airways even considered ordering this plane for its Australia-New Zealand routes. However, development ended when Saunders Row couldn't land any orders, and airlines didn't want to invest into a plane that wasn't being developed because it didn't get any orders. You kind of see the loop catch-22 here. With two strikes on the board, Saunders Row thought to give up flying boats. But then at the last minute, the P&O Shipping Company reached out to them. Would there be a way to turn the Princess and Duchess into a flying ocean liner? Of course, the problem wasn't propellers or the engines. It was that the plane wasn't big enough. So they took the Duchess and turned it into a double capacity version with twin decks. Naturally, this was a hint of what's to come, and the design quickly escalated into five decks, and this would become the Queen that we know and love. Alas, once this design was complete, the government and P&O balked at the price that they were asking and said, no thanks, we'll invest in land planes and boats instead. So Saunders Row would pivot with a few more designs. They hurriedly went back to the Princess and proposed to turn it into a land plane, removing the water hull and replacing it with a streamlined fuselage with wheels to land on proper runways. They would also update the engines to make them more efficient from the original weaker design. And when that was thrown against the wall, they went even more crazy. They took a big bold step and, working with the US government, proposed a nuclear-powered version. That's right, a nuclear-powered seaplane. This would eventually be spun up by Lockheed into its Tug concept that was also a seaplane, and that's a video that you can watch on the channel. And while the US government said no to this nuclear-powered version, Saunders Row would throw one last Hail Mary towards the government and say, hey, we can create a twin hull design to carry those Saturn V rockets for the Apollo program, which I just think looks stunning. But like every other design before this, the answer was a resounding no. So what exactly happened? Why did the flying boat go extinct, and why did nobody actually want it? The story of how flying boats disappeared from our skies is actually pretty fascinating, and it's basically about them being in the wrong place at the wrong time. The Saunders Row Princess, for example, the massive flying boat showing up, came just when aviation was changing, and not in its favour. After World War II, airports were popping up everywhere. All those military airfields built during the war were being turned into civilian airports with proper concrete runways. Suddenly, one of the flying boat's biggest selling points, being able to land on water when there wasn't any runways around, wasn't such a big deal anymore. And then came the jets, like the de Havilland Comet and the Boeing 707, which completely changed the game. Flying boats had always been stuck with a major design headache. They needed a boat-shaped bottom to land on water. That extra weight and drag wasn't doing them any favors when competing with sleek, purpose-built land planes that could fly higher and faster. And what really killed them off was the maintenance nightmare. Salt water is incredibly corrosive, and keeping these giant boats in flying shape was a constant battle. The Princess itself fell victim to this. The government finally stopped scratching their heads and found a buyer who wanted to start up a very specific cargo and passenger airline using flying boats. But they were in storage for so long that they started to rot away from corrosion. So talk about adding insult to injury. But the final nail in the coffin was that planes had just become more reliable. Back in the day, being able to land on water in an emergency was a huge safety feature for long flights over the ocean. But with better engines and more airports along popular routes, this just wasn't important anymore. The Princess and other flying boats just became solutions to problems that didn't exist. Now, I didn't touch on it, but Saunders Row also was working on a fighter jet version, which was actually really cool and would still have quite the practical application today. But I would love to do a whole video about it on the future, so be sure to subscribe and hang around for that.